Happy Friday, everybody. My name is Mike Cutler. I welcome you to my program, the Michael Cutler Hour, where at the end of the week we get to sit down and have an hour-long discussion about the lunacy of the world, especially where it impacts the United States of America, our citizens, and particularly with concern to national security and the freedoms and other measures that we've come to expect as citizens of this great nation. My background is that of an immigration agent. I spent 30 years with the former INS. I've done a bunch of congressional hearings after the terrorist attacks of 9/11. If you want to read more about me, there's two great websites you can go to. You can go to my own personal website, and that website, of course, is michaelcutler.net, C-U-T-L-E-R, michaelcutler.net. And I'm also thrilled to be doing a program for an organization known as AND Magazine. And my website on AND Magazine is talkborder.com. One word, talkborder, T-A-L-K-B-O-R-D-E-R, talkborder.com. And finally, for those of you who are familiar with me, you know that for a number of years I've been proud to be a senior fellow with an organization known as CAPS, Californians for Population Stabilization. And they, of course, have published a number of my commentaries on their great website at capsweb.org. But right now I am sitting here just contemplating the madness of the preceding week. We will be joined very shortly by a very talented and experienced young lady by the name of Sherilyn Harley LeBron. I will let you tell I will let her tell you about her impressive background, including a member of the National Advisory Council on Project 21 Black Leadership Network. She's a president and CEO of CLAR, K-L-A-R Strategies. She was also a senior counsel for the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee. And we're going to be talking about some of the lunacy that passes for public policy. The government seems determined to protect us from ourselves, or perhaps maybe not so much. But she'll be joining us, and we have Judy Kent of the National Center for Public Policy Research to thank for introducing Sherilyn to me and to my program. But meanwhile, I just want to give you guys out there a little bit of something to think about. It's something that I say wherever I go, and it's the importance of the First Amendment. The First Amendment, many people will immediately, by reflex, rote memory, say, well, freedom of speech, freedom of press, freedom of religion. Well, that's right. But there's two other very critically important components to the First Amendment that often get glossed over, ignored, and overlooked. And that's the right to seek redress for grievances from our government. And boy, oh boy, as they say, if you ain't mad, you ain't paying attention, there's a long list of grievances. And the other issue is that the Founding Fathers, in their wisdom, and I say this in all sincerity because I am in awe of what they accomplished in putting this great nation together, roughly a quarter of a millennium ago, talked about the right for peaceable assemblage, the right to peaceably assemble. And this is really very important, and it's something that we've seemed to have lost the ability to do. Because back in the days when this nation was founded, there was no internet, there was no Facebook, there was no telephone, there was no radio, there was no talk radio. There was no other way of communicating with somebody other than writing a note and hope that somehow it got delivered. Ben Franklin, of course, started the post office. But to really have discourse, debate, discussion, you needed to do it face-to-face, person-to-person, standing toe-to-toe and nose-to-nose with somebody. Back then, they had the discourse under a shade tree, perhaps in a house of worship, a church, a synagogue, in a school, in someone's living room, in a building of some sort. Today, of course, through the miracle of the internet, electronic communications, there are so many opportunities for us to have meetings of the minds so that people of divergent viewpoints could get together and give some thought to what the other side has to say. And unfortunately, for far too many programs that are out there, and those of you who are familiar with my efforts, especially since 9/11, after my 30-year career with the INS ended, know how many programs I've been on, whether it's radio or television. And very often, what passes for discourse is a food fight. You get on some program, they give you 3 minutes to have an argument with somebody, basically, who may or may not know what he or she is talking about, and then they break for a commercial, and they move on to some other topic of the day. Nothing gets resolved in that kind of a situation. Nobody really learns anything in that situation. All this seems to do is to cause people to dig in their heels and say, I'm not changing my position. And today, if a politician dares to say, well, you know, maybe I had a particular issue wrong, his opponents will call him a waffle. Oh, my God, he's a waffle. She's a waffle. Well, if you keep going back and forth, depending on the audience you're standing in front of, then certainly you are a waffle, and you haven't really staked out a position. You've become what I call a human weather vane. You stick a wet finger into the air and try to figure out from whence the wind blows. But really and truly, life is an educational experience. I try to make a point of learning something new each and every day, that I'm given the gift of another day of life, the ability to get out of bed and stand on both feet and go about my business. And that's what we really need to do. And as you learn, sometimes viewpoints will change. But I have to tell you, it is a rare program that provides enough information that's going to persuade anybody of any about any issue that a new perspective might be in order. And that's what I attempt to do here on this program, the Michael Cutler Hour. And I will also shamelessly plug my effort at And Magazine at TalkBorder.com, because that's what I do there. If you go to TalkBorder.com, which is my website, you will see I recently, in fact, had a debate with a gentleman by the name of Matt Sky, who was one of the occupiers. And I know there are people that are going to say, oh, my God, the occupiers. You know what? As long as people act responsibly, nonviolently, and decently, we need to take into account everyone's perspective. It doesn't mean we have to agree with it, but it means that they are entitled to be listened to, as long as they're being reasonable. Because we want other sides, people on the other sides of the issue, to think about what we have to say. It's a lot of fun, and I do a lot of public speaking. And if you want to get a hold of me for an event, you can reach me through my website. You can reach me through Ann Magazine or MichaelCutler.net. But when you're out there speaking to an audience that agrees with you, boy, it's great. Everyone is cheering and applauding, and that's fine. But really and truly, if America is going to go in the direction it needs to go in, then we need to perhaps get some other people to understand the real issues. The first step in problem solving is to identify the problems. The first step to problem solving is to be honest about the issues and what threatens us and what needs to be done to fix things. And the only way that that's going to happen is to go back to that fundamental underlying principle about the First Amendment, the right for peaceable assembly, so that people can sit down and maybe learn something from somebody that has a different perspective, different experience, different educations. So that's something that has become a lost art in America. In the name of political correctness, we've become cowardly. You know, if your goal in being politically correct is to not insult, embarrass, denigrate, or demean another human being, then you're certainly doing the right thing. If, on the other hand, political correctness is being used as a way to intimidate people, as a way of calling names when all else fails, and we see this with the immigration issue all the time. The open border anarchists, as I've come to call them, will say, well, if you don't want to open the borders, if you don't want to give pathways of citizenship to unknown millions of illegal aliens, then you're a racist and you hate people with brown skin. I mean, if you stop and think about it, nothing could be further from the truth. But it's the kind of assertion that the open borders crowd uses all the time and with great effect. People, without thinking, will hear these things and say, wow, that's what's behind it. Never giving thought to the fact that our nation's immigration laws have as their goal, the foundation of those laws, are two priorities. Priority number one, protect American lives. Priority number two, protect American jobs. And it's easy to prove it, because if you go to Title 8 of the United States Code, Section 212, and those of you familiar with my program know I don't like to get heavily into the law, but this is an issue of law. So if you get the chance, do that, or go to my website, or go to capsweb.org and look it up, because I've written about this. 212 lists the categories of aliens who are supposed to be kept out of the United States, and it starts with aliens with dangerous communicable diseases, aliens who suffer mental illness and are prone to violence or sex offenders, convicted felons, human rights violators, war criminals, spies, terrorists, gang members, and so forth. So stop and give it some thought. If in point of fact, you're unable to keep those folks out of the country, then you can't protect our country. You cannot protect our citizens. And the Labor Department used to be responsible for running the Immigration Service. They were responsible for enforcing the laws, because back before the Second World War, it was a clear understanding that if you permitted people into the country to work in unlimited numbers, you would ultimately destroy job opportunities for Americans. Labor is a commodity. Just like any other commodity, if you flood the market, you drive down the value of that commodity. That's what's happening now. It's happening at the bottom rung with illegal aliens who work on the tough manual jobs. It's happening with visa fraud at the upper level when we look at the H-1B visas and the computer programmers. So that, in reality, is wherein lies the problem that we are having. We need to understand that those laws are designed to protect us, not to discriminate. There's nothing in the law that deals with anything at all relating back to the discrimination or separating of people based on race, religion, or ethnicity. So that's really what people need to come to an understanding about, is that our immigration laws, simply stated, are designed to protect us, we the people. So that again, is in essence what it is that we're looking to accomplish. But you'd never know it by all the name-calling, by all of this nasty stuff that goes on in the name of the open borders objectives and so forth. Very disturbing way to do business, but unfortunately, this is where we've gone. This is exactly where things now stand. So with that in mind, I just want you to understand the nature of what it is that we are confronting today. I'm still waiting for my guest to join us. Hopefully she will be along with us shortly. But while we're waiting for Sherrilyn to show up, in fact, I'm going to do something unusual. I'm going to go offline for one moment, folks, while I try to reach her and make sure that she knows how to get into the program, because she is an amazing guest, and I'm certainly looking forward to having her join us. So if you stand by one moment, I will hopefully have her on the line. Sorry about that, folks. Sherrilyn will be joining us momentarily. Wanted to make sure she was with us today. So understand what it is we're confronting here in this great nation. We are now dealing with a serious problem, and the problem is one of our own making, because if we the people don't get involved in the issues, don't make our politicians accountable, don't educate ourselves and demand honest answers from the people who are placed in leadership positions, then we wind up getting the short end of the stick. And believe me, we are getting the short end of the stick these days. And in large measure, we the people bear responsibility, because this is supposed to be a government by the people. We are the employers of all who are elected to... So the situation that we're now confronting is that we are now dealing with a government that's running amok. In fact, when Sherrilyn comes on, we're going to be talking momentarily. In fact, she's here right now. Let me get her on without further delay.
Hello.
Hello, Sherrilyn. Finally, here you are.
Hello.
How are you today? Thank you so much for joining me on the program.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Sherrilyn, could you tell my audience a little bit about yourself?
I am trained as a lawyer.
We won't hold that against you, by the way.
Right? I've worked in and out of politics for almost now 20 years, worked as a spokesperson at the RNC during the 2000 election, have worked as a communication strategist at the National Republican Senatorial Committee, worked as a political appointee in the Bush administration at the Veterans Affairs Department, as well as an assistant administrator at the Small Business Administration. And I'm also a former senior counsel on Senate Judiciary Committee.
Well, and of course you started when you were 8 years old to have crammed that much career into such a... and I also understand that you're a mom, and you know, I'm a parent, I'm a father. And I think that we also have to look at that job that we all hold down, because this is about the future that we will ultimately provide to our children. Would you not agree?
Absolutely. And to me, that's what the struggle right now in our country is about. It's about the legacy that we are leaving to our children. And the current situation is not one that I'm happy about leaving to my children. We've got an enormous amount of debt. We've got 50% of all young people now who are either having trouble finding a job or are unemployed. I don't think the future is very bright for them, and I worry about the future for my little ones who are 4 and 7 years old, respectively.
Oh, that's a great age.
It is.
And you know, what's so remarkable, and I know that you were over at the RNC, and I work with a lot of the folks there. I've been working with the Senator Grassley's people. I'm sure that you're familiar with his staff, and I know Grassley's doing a tremendous job.
Tremendous job. And he's also a member who has been always very concerned about whistleblowers. He does a lot of work on whistleblowers, a lot.
Well, you know, I worked with him on the Violence Against Women's Act, and we brought in Julie Poner, who was a classic example, an American citizen who was taken advantage of by an alien spouse. I've worked with his counsel on providing some background stuff where Fast and Furious is concerned. But before we go off the beaten path, I just want to start out with the latest craziness, because I'm convinced sometimes that the newspaper headlines are written by Rod Serling in the Twilight Zone, not in the real world. I think we're in a parallel universe.
It really sometimes feels that way, to be honest with you.
And to be honest, I think both sides of the aisle bear a lot of responsibility. The current administration leaves me apoplectic. I'm registered as a Democrat. I can't tell you the last time I was enthusiastic about any Democrat on the federal level in terms of elected representatives. But, you know, we got into this mess, I think, because of both sides, although this administration... leaves me shaking my head.
I would have to say, as you know, I'm a card-carrying Republican. I drink Kool-Aid. But I've got to tell you, this administration is really moving us towards, I think, a socialist economy, towards an economy that more mirrors Europeans. It's all very troubling to me. Very, very troubling.
And then you pick up the headline that we talked about before you came on the program today about the diet of people in Massachusetts. Do you want to talk about that for a moment, and then we'll branch out?
Let's talk about that. First of all, to give your listeners a little bit of background, this is based on a recent obesity study that came out through these quasi-federal sort of organizations, right?
Right.
It's Institute of Medicine and a couple other organizations, which, you know, are federally funded. And the problem here is that the study in itself is flawed. And let me just give you one example of how it's flawed. They're predicting that in 20 years, 42% of all Americans are going to be obese. Okay?
Okay.
Now, what they base it on, and it's just follow me here for a minute, part of what they're basing it on is predicting the number of fast food restaurants that will exist in 2 decades.
Are you kidding me? I didn't see the article. That's unbelievable.
Right. So follow the logic here. So they're saying that 42% of Americans are going to be obese because they're basing it on an estimated number of fast food restaurants that will be in the United States, because they're making an assumption about certain percentages of Americans who are going to eat at these fast food restaurants. Therefore, they're making the nexus. They made a nexus between the number of fast food restaurants that they're predicting we're going to have in 20 years, and the nexus is the how many Americans will be eating at them. Therefore, because Americans are eating percentage of time at these fast food restaurants, they're predicting how many are going to be obese. Now, let's just take this logic a minute here. No one, not even Wall Street analysts, can predict such things. How many fast food restaurants we will have? In other words, how many small businesses will exist in the United States is something we cannot predict. It's based on available venture capital. It's based on market research and other market factors. No one's able to predict that. And 20 years from now, you don't even know what kind of restaurants will exist. I mean,
so they've become futurists now.
Exactly. This is the type of flawed study that exists. Now, work with me here a minute. So based on this flawed study, you have Massachusetts that says, oh, my gosh, Chicken Little, the sky is falling. We're going to have, you know, a third of our students are already obese in the state of Massachusetts. And now we have this study, and 42% of all Americans are going to be obese in 20 years. So now we're going to have to ban cupcakes. This is
the type
of flawed logic you've got, right? Because everybody read the study and said, oh, my gosh, we're going to be obese, so what are we going to do? Now, just late Thursday afternoon, the state of Massachusetts walked this ban back, okay? They walked it back. And now they said, we're not gonna outright ban bake sales, because they had this fury and this outrage from parents. As you know, bake sales are crucial to the booster clubs, to raising money for lacrosse and uniforms, arts and crafts, after school programs,
I don't know if you know this, but I was the Parents Association president of my daughter's public school way back when.
See,
so absolutely.
You get it. So you know, these regulations were set to take effect August 1st, and then there was all the pushback, and now they've said no. Deval Patrick, the governor, said this is not going to happen. They're not going to do this. There was too much pushback, and they're not moving forward.
You know, this is interesting, and here's what's interesting, because just before you came on, I was talking about the First Amendment, because I always like to talk about the First Amendment, because my concern is that it's more than about freedom of speech, freedom of press, and freedom of religion. As important as those three components are, it's about the right to seek redress of grievances and the right to peaceably assemble so that people can get together and come to better understandings through debate, discourse, and if need be, argument. Now, look at what happened, because the citizenry of that location banded together and said, no, you don't. This is democratic action in action. The idea
this
that
the
people forced the point.
This is the way it should happen in America. Yes. This is the way it should happen in America. Now, let me just add this, though.
Go ahead.
The ban is going to stay in effect, however, during the day, and the goodies can't be sold at school cafeterias during the school day. But the original intent of the law is they were just banning bake sales altogether, and that included in the evening as well. So evening events in general, right? Like all across the board, no bake sales. So now they've walked it back, and they've just said the goodies can't be sold at the school cafeterias during the school day. I'm fine with that because, you know, I'm not there during the school with my daughter. So I don't want her to have a dollar, which I've given her perhaps for milk or something else, and then she's going to use it to buy a cupcake. I mean, I'm okay with that. I think that is.
But this comes back to the idea of compromise and reasonableness.
Yes, exactly. The original bill was not reasonable at all. There was nothing reasonable about doing an outright ban on bake sales, in particular to combat this estimated 42% of all Americans are going to be obese in 20 years. No, that didn't make any sense whatsoever.
But you know what? What I also find remarkable, and this is another issue that I often speak about, you know, while I spent 30 years working for what was the INS, I started as an inspector, spent a year as an adjudicator, and I was an agent for 26 years. Half of my career was with the Drug Task Force. I was assigned to DEA Intelligence for about 4 years, became a senior agent with the Organized Crime Drug Enforcement Task Force. We spend tons of money on a so-called war on drugs. Probably 70% of crime in America, directly or indirectly, is related to drugs, whether it's the drug sales that are crimes all by themselves, the violence perpetrated by the thugs trying to control turf or whatever, crimes committed by addicts seeking to feed their habits. We can go on forever. But then you look at, with all of the so-called war on drugs, not a single commercial being issued by the federal government warning anybody about the dangers of cocaine or heroin, but lots of commercials warning us about salt and sugar. What do you think is a bigger threat to someone's well-being, that extra spoonful of sugar in their cup of coffee in the morning, or the guy that's snorting cocaine or shooting up heroin?
The guy that's snorting cocaine and shooting up heroin and doing all this other illegal activity that we've got going on, whether it be in urban and rural areas, along the border. I mean, you know, let's focus on what's important. And, I just find this interesting in general, what, like, the latest news that people have been focusing on in the past, I'd say, let's call it 4 weeks.
Okay.
War on women, gay marriage. You know, these are all, in my opinion, diversionary tactics. Because
yep.
In my world of being a mom, of being a lacrosse mom, of raising my family, and just being an ordinary citizen in America, the people I know, the moms I know, are concerned about three things. Number one, gas prices. What has this administration done? Why do we have $5 gas? My daughter has lacrosse 3 days a week. I'm burning gas driving all around the city, driving from one activity to another, driving the carpool. Second, safety. How safe is our country, and how safe is this world for my children? I'm not feeling very safe these days, considering I'm looking at this president's non-existent foreign policy, and the Middle East is melting down before our eyes. You've got a situation in Syria. Kofi Annan has not been successful at all with Syria. And he would admit it. I mean, just today I read an article in the Post that said, you know, he thinks he's failed. Well, that's pretty clear.
Yep.
Syria's closest ally is Iran. Oh, this doesn't make us feel safe at all. And North Korea and Iran are buddies. This is the makings of a perfect storm, considering the fact that North Korea is always on the hunt for money. For somehow to feed their starving people, and Iran is looking for nukes, and North Korea has the nukes. So right there you have just a perfect storm.
So now, forgive me, Charlotte, but now let's take another step forward. And in fact, on my program, and we should have it posted on my Talk Border website by this weekend, I did an interview with a California professor who's here in New York, David Meyer Levy. We talked about radical Islam in Latin America. And I'm not sure if you'd seen the Pentagon reports that came out in 2010, but Iran has stationed their Quds troops, their shock troops, the elite guard of Iran, in Venezuela, and with increasing numbers coming every single week. So they have their troops in Venezuela. How difficult is it for somebody from the Middle East to spend several years in Latin America, totally immersed in the language, the culture, and so forth of Latin America, so that Mohammed could then claim to be Miguel? We have terrorist training camps in the tri-border region of Brazil, Hamas, Hezbollah, and Al-Qaeda, and Hezbollah, again, affiliated with Iran. We know that Robert Mueller, the head of the FBI, has been before innumerable congressional hearings, where he talked about sleeper agents coming to America to do harm. And we have Ahmadinejad saying, you know, if Israel attacks their nuclear program, they will come after the United States because they're a client state of America.
Exactly.
So now you put all those puzzle pieces together, the fact that we now have, and by the way, do not buy this 11 million figure. I think we have probably 30 to 35 million illegal aliens in our country.
Oh, I would absolutely agree with you. Absolutely agree.
And now here's my question. We don't know their true names. That means we don't know anything about their background, even their nationality, or why they're here, or who they're affiliated with. We have an administration that keeps talking about the need to put these people who are here illegally on a pathway to citizenship, making fools out of anybody who came legally and spent the time and money that the law requires. And by the way, we admit over 1.1 million lawful immigrants every year, and they're immediately on the pathway to citizenship. That's more than the rest of the world combined. So we're bringing in this labor force. You were talking about jobs. I confronted Newt Gingrich because I was given the distinct privilege of addressing the Tea Party convention in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, a couple of months ago, and Newt was there. In fact, he was up on stage just before I was. And I bumped into him in the bar that night, and I said, Mr. Speaker, can you explain to me why, with all the talk about the need to create jobs, you're not talking about the need to liberate jobs? Everyone gets excited. We created 100,000 jobs last week. Whoopee. You have unknown millions of illegal aliens working throughout the United States. If you enforce the immigration laws, you don't need to invest time or money to liberate those jobs. As you're taking the illegal workforce out the back door, you could be bringing in the legal workforce through the front door without anybody investing any money or wasting any time. Yet when was the last time you heard any politician from either party addressing that issue?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, our immigration, I mean, that is a three-hour conversation. We have failed to address it now for many years, and the problem continues to escalate. As our world becomes more and more complicated, just as you indicated, you know, with Muslims going over to South America, learning the language, and then making their way into the United States, I mean, we live in a very complex society, and we are long overdue for addressing these issues. Long overdue.
And you know what bothered me, and I know you're a Republican, and I'm sure that you were involved in coming up with Republican strategies, and I have a bunch of friends on the Hill who've been on both sides of the aisle. But when George W. Bush said, we're going to have a guest worker program, and we'll just let those in that want to work, I thought I was going to have a hissy fit. I thought my head was going to explode because, you know, the day before a terrorist attack, a terrorist hides in plain sight by going to the job he or she has been doing for the last year or two.
Right.
Where
that's
they don't
right.
call attention to themselves, and they usually want jobs that provide them with two things, mobility and camouflage. They drive taxi cabs,
exactly.
airport vans, ice cream trucks, whatever.
Yep.
So,
I mean, we know this is the modus operandi, right?
Yep, and we've seen it time and again. I provided testimony to the 9/11 Commission. I was called to testify before Congress May of 1997 after the first two terrorist attacks, the first of which one of those two attacks almost brought down the towers the first time around. And you would have thought that the Clinton administration would have learned the lessons that those two attacks should have taught us in 93. First, this guy Cansey shoots up the CIA. He was a Pakistani national, got political asylum by committing fraud. 1 month later, attack at the Trade Center. Six people killed, perhaps thousands injured, $500 million in damage. They almost brought it down sideways. The Clinton administration did nothing, which left the door literally and figuratively wide open for 9/11. And then we have George W. Bush not securing the borders, not going after immigration fraud, not going after – do you know it took the Bush administration till August of 2002 to end the transit without visa program when that should have been ended the day after 9/11?
Oh, that's a very good point. That's a very good point.
And we keep expanding the visa waiver program. Richard Reid was the shoe bomber. He's the reason when I travel, and I do a lot of traveling because I do a lot of public speaking, I have loafers that I prefer to wear on airplanes because I know the shoes have to come off.
Yeah, absolutely.
But
shoes
Reid
have to come
could
off.
Have entered without a visa, and he could still get on an airplane without a visa today. They've expanded it to 36 countries because of the Chamber of Commerce.
Yeah, and there are thousands of Richard Reids like that in this country who are here. They're here. And they've been here for years.
Uh-huh.
They have been here for years, and they're not going anywhere. All they're doing is creating trouble. And it's interesting you brought up the point about the radical Islamists going to Venezuela, because, you know, they, just as we like to think the free market capitalist countries stick together, let me tell you, all the communists and socialists, and they're brutal. The ones with brutal regimes,
yep.
Where, for example, you take in North Korea, which has these concentration camps,
yep.
Which they, you know, you can see them on Google Earth, right? You
yep.
Pull up Google Earth, and you can see these labor camps, which the North Koreans continue to deny. So you know that North Korea is in cahoots with Iran and in cahoots with Castro in Cuba and
yep.
In cahoots with Chavez. I mean, they're just moving their people around those countries and moving nukes and moving arms. I mean, they've got their own, you know, brutal regime passing where people are dying left and right. And it's terrible because they all live well. I mean, for example, the whole Kim, you know, the whole Kim dynasty, they've got, you know, they live in mansions with tennis courts, and people are starving in North Korea, starving. And then to think how they live in Saudi Arabia or in Yemen, where little girls are being married off at 9 years old, and the rulers of these countries are living high on the hog when the women are being raped and abused. I mean, it's really, whenever I hear people, Americans, complaining about the United States, I very politely say, oh, really? Well, have you been to Yemen? You think women are discriminated in the United States? Try going to China. Try going to Yemen. Try going to Sudan and Congo.
You raise an interesting word that I just heard, and we have to go to that now, because I was thinking about it as you were saying a couple of other things. China is still a communist country.
Oh, it is very much now. I mean, now, you can call it pseudo, because when you go to countries, I don't know if you've ever been there, but when you go to Shanghai and Beijing, the urbanized cities, oh, it's very capitalist. You see a KFC on every corner, McDonald's,
yep.
Starbucks, all that stuff. But when
yep.
you go to the countryside, when you go to the countryside, you have open sewers, clearly no EPA, no OSHA, absolutely nothing. And the people are poor. That's where they push all, I mean, just beyond poor, but living in you know, sort of 1800 standards
squalor.
In the United States.
Utter squalor.
Yes, beyond squalor. I mean, horrible. And that's where they put people who have AIDS, who are handicapped, people who they consider to be embarrassments.
And who is underwriting all of those cities that you described as these shining examples? We have. Our corporations
have. We
have.
They own us. They own us now. Come on. Our debt. Our debt is you know, China owns our debt. China owns our debt. And how sad is that? A country with all of these human rights violations, this poor blind lawyer here. I mean, why is he being treated the way he's being treated? Because he vigorously opposed the one-child policy. He witnessed all these women being killed who had
mm-hmm.
babies. And this is how they're treating him. And I must say, not great how this administration handled that situation. That negotiation was just flawed from the get-go.
That was the fact that we have corporations building all sorts of equipment in China. They don't recognize intellectual property rights. Patents and trademarks mean nothing. They reverse engineer everything. We've given them our debt. We've given them our technology. They are here in the Western Hemisphere. Forget about the Monroe Doctrine. You know, I think back to JFK and the Cuban Missile Crisis. I'm old enough to have remembered that vividly. I was in high school at the time. We were stood at the precipice of a nuclear war. And now you have Venezuela with foreign soldiers being quartered in their country. They are building missiles in Venezuela that can reach the southern half of the United States. We have China competing with us for petroleum and precious metals and all sorts of resources, and we're treating them as our ally, as our trading partner.
Exactly, trading partner. And
where am I
know,
getting
want-
this? And by the way, that goes back, of course, to Richard Nixon. It goes back to George Bush Sr. This goes back to both political parties, to be very fair about
Absolutely.
And you know where this comes from? Campaign finance, as far as I'm concerned. As a federal agent, I wasn't allowed to accept a cup of coffee from anybody. I mean, think about this one, Cheryl. And could you imagine if I had gone to the guy in charge of investigations in New York when I was an agent and said, Walter, you should be proud of me because I'm the best fundraiser in the office?
Oh, yeah, that wouldn't
Now, how quickly would I have been in front of a grand jury, and properly in front of a grand jury? And these folks take money with both hands, and when they brag about it, they have their supporters standing behind them clapping like a bunch of trained seals.
Mm-hmm.
What is wrong with this picture?
Well, campaign finance is one of those topics where we have abuse on both sides.
Absolutely.
Unless both sides come together and be willing to really do the hard work, it's going to stay the way it is. And
but
I
you
don't
know what I wonder is this.
That.
But what I wonder is this: the emphasis right now for so much of that money that they're taking in, and it's gazillions of dollars, is about TV ads.
But think about it. Last night, Obama raised $15 million in Hollywood.
With George Clooney's help and the other folks
with
in Hollywood, I saw that.
$1,000 a plate. But here's what really galls me with the Democrats and this limousine.
I can't tell that you're worked up, by the way, Cheryl, and I don't hear it in your voice at all.
It's a limousine liberal. They're complaining about the 1%, and they say that they support the poor and OWS. How can you say that?
But here's my question.
$1,000 a plate?
But here's my question. Expensive dinnerware, I guess.
I mean,
but here's my question.
It's so annoying.
It's more than annoying.
Really, Mike.
When you hear about bundlers taking the money, and tell me that a bundler could not easily become a money launderer.
Yeah. You know, I suppose you could.
I mean, so what, all it does is you cover the tracks of where the money came from. Just give them lots of $25 donations, and they bundle it together. I mean, the accountability where campaign finance is concerned is non-existent.
Yeah.
It's non-existent. It's all about creating illusions, whether it's about border security that doesn't exist. You have Janet Napolitano, the head of DHS, and, you know, I've come to call the Department of Homeland Security the Department of Homeland Surrender. How on earth...
I mean, this pathetic TSA. It seems like every week they're doing some stupid thing. You just saw an 18-month-old was detained. I mean, you know, they're frisking 85-year-old grandmas. I mean, come on. I mean,
well,
yes,
you know, but here's the solution.
Ludicrous.
They have over 60,000 people at the TSA. Maybe if they took half of them and put them on the border and threatened to grope the illegal aliens running the border, it might slow some of them down. I guess some of them might like it. I don't know. But all joking aside, how do you have the money to hire over 60,000 people for TSA and you have about 6 or 7,000 ICE agents for the whole country? If you can get past the inspector at the port of entry, if you can get past the Border Patrol, you're home free in America, and you have an administration that won't move to deport you unless you've not committed serious crimes but been convicted of committing serious crimes. Otherwise, once you get here, they're happy to give you employment authorization, give you every lawful right to take a job that now competes with an American who's losing his or her home to foreclosure.
That's right. And that foreclosure rate is not going down. Why? Because it's all about jobs. And that was my first point. The first one is keeping America safe. The first one was gas prices. The second one was keeping America safe. And the third one is failed economic policies of this administration. 8.1% unemployment.
But, you know, look, in all honesty, George W. didn't do any better at enforcing the immigration laws.
Okay, I know, Mike. Immigration is your thing. But
I'll tell you why it's just not my thing and why it's so important. If you look at the remittances, we're losing over $100 billion a year in remittances right out of the economy. That's money that's not earned by Americans. It's money that's not spent or invested in America. It's permitting an influx of gang members and crime. It's permitting terrorists to embed themselves in our country. It's undermining American workers, and not just at the bottom rung. Look at the fraud involved in the H-1B visas, the L visas. So we have programmers, engineers, and technicians who aren't getting the jobs. They go to school. They get student loans that look more like mortgage payments. And then they find out that some guy from India who will work for $45,000 a year is now getting the job that they were trained for their entire lives.
Mm-hmm. what's happening. That is what's happening.
And
back to the economic issues. I know we've got. I know you feel we've got immigration problems, but I'm back to the economics. Our future, 50% of all youth are having trouble finding a job or unemployed. This is our future.
But if we started to rely on Americans to do the jobs rather than foreign workers, think how that could change things. Think of what happened when Katrina hit. They eliminated the I-9 requirement, so illegal aliens went to work in New Orleans. Imagine if Bush had gone into the rough neighborhoods and found kids that maybe had minor scrapes with the law, went to the Labor Department and said, you know what, you help us rebuild New Orleans, we'll help you rebuild your lives. We'll give you the training so that you can become the plumbers and the bricklayers. My dad was a plumber. There's nothing ignoble about being a tradesman.
Electrician, plumber, and mechanic. Find me one any day.
Carpenters, roofers, bricklayers, iron workers, they're the backbone of America.
They are. They absolutely are.
And they're the Rodney Dangerfield professions, you know. They get no respect, but they deserve all the respect.
Exactly.
So, you know, that's why I talk a lot about immigration, not just because it's my area of expertise, but you can't name a major challenge or threat that isn't getting hammered. It costs, according to the Congressional Budget Office, it costs 20 to 40% more to educate a kid who comes to college with no English proficiency.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I mean, I just see it in our schools in Fairfax County. There are some schools that are 70% ESL. 70% ESL.
English is a second language, for those of you not familiar with the alphabet soup. Yep.
And you know, frankly, to be honest with you, Mike, that brings down the standards of the school. I mean, just
absolutely.
Think how it impedes
the class when you have a teacher
who looks
into a class filled with kids that can't speak the language.
Right. I mean, you're lowering the standards. And in the summer, our pool has a lot of teachers because they're home in the summer.
Right.
And there's a lot of teachers hanging out in the pool, and they're tutoring, right?
Right.
And I always say to them, because my kids don't go to public school. They go to private school for the reasons I just articulated.
Right.
And they said, well, the problem, what I don't agree, one of the teachers said this to me last summer. She says, what I don't agree is that we're not forcing the kids who are ESL to work at the standards that we have established. And we're setting them up for failure. And she said, let me give you an example. It's just throwing out a number. If the requirement for third graders is to read 10 books in a certain amount of time, they tell the ESL kids that they only have to read 3.
That's
so
remarkable.
They lower the standards so that these kids are not forced to work up to standards, to everyone else's standards, to the mean.
Yeah, but you know why that's done, too. It's done to cook the book so they could say they're getting the grade.
So they can say we passed them, we've got the grade, you know, blah, blah, blah.
And what they're forgetting is that the whole purpose to school is that it's a dress rehearsal for the rest of your life.
Yeah, and here's the thing. Think about it. If these kids are constantly not working up to the standards, then how are they going to improve themselves? How are these kids going to be able to take the standardized test that gets you into law school and medical school and the CPA exam, right? I mean, because we're not doing any special bar exam for ESL kids, okay?
No, it doesn't work that way. That's right.
That's not how it works. There are bar exams for every state, and doesn't matter what language you speak, English is what's it, right? The laws are the laws. Medicine is medicine, and you need to be able to communicate in English, period. The standardized tests are going to be in English.
Yeah, but not so much. In New York, you can cast a ballot in how many different languages when they give you the material before you go into the booth?
You can get a driver's license
in 12 languages
that,
in New York?
You know, I got to tell you this, Mike. I have a problem with that. I speak 4 languages. I have lived and worked around the world. One of the countries I've lived and worked in is Germany. When you go to get your visa in Germany, they don't do the interview in English. It's done in German.
As it should be.
You know, they don't find anyone to come and speak English for you. Your German has to be good enough that you need to talk to those civil servants in the language of the country.
You know what, Sherilyn?
My mother came to the United States.
My mother came to the United States ahead of the Holocaust. She was 14 years old, lived in a rooming house by herself, worked in an umbrella factory. She was a legal immigrant. Her first order of business was to learn English. She spoke Polish and Yiddish. My dad's family came from Russia, Romania at the turn of the last century. They spoke Yiddish and Russian. First order of business, learn English. You know, we don't need to be of the same race, religion, or ethnicity. I love diversity. That's why I couldn't imagine living anywhere but New York City. I'm a native New Yorker. But you know what? It's a common language that is the mortar that holds a society or a nation together. We are turning our country into a Tower of Babel.
Exactly. It's very unfortunate. I mean, if you don't force people to learn the language of their country, they're constantly going to be playing catch up. They can't assimilate in society. Their kids aren't. I mean, I just think when you've got a school where 70% of the kids are ESL, who's helping those kids do their homework at night? I mean, I can tell you, my daughter has had homework every night since kindergarten.
Yep.
Okay? Every night. And it's a drill. We come in, what's your homework? We have to sign her homework at night. Every night we got to sign her homework. I mean, it's a drill. And it takes time to sit down, do your homework. She's got book reports every month.
Right.
How are these kids, who's helping them with their homework? As the parents don't speak English.
But also, look at what we now have. More children being born out of wedlock. And I'm a liberal on most issues. But this idea of massive numbers of kids being born out of wedlock, being raised by children themselves and children who have not been successful in society very often.
It's just a shame. It's an absolute shame. Well, I tell you, Mike, this has been lovely. I hope I can come back on again with you. It's just been great.
Sherilyn, it's been fabulous having you. I have to, you know, you bring such a wealth of experience and perspectives. We definitely have to get you back on this program. And I want you to come over to Talk Border, and we can do a Skype, which is a video that I do once a week over at AND Magazine.
I would love to. Let's get it set up. And I think I have your email. And I'll email you tonight, and we'll get some stuff set up.
Absolutely. But I want to thank you for all the hard work you've been doing, because next time I want to talk about Project 21 also, for the next time, perhaps.
Absolutely.
Judy Kent is an amazing resource. You guys all do amazing work, I have to tell you. And I thank you for the hard work you've been doing for our country.
Thank you very much. It's been my pleasure. Again, I do this, as I always say on Twitter, I live to fight another day, but I do it because I've got little ones. And,
you betcha.
I want them to have a wonderful life, and I love this country, and it's the greatest country on earth.
If you look at those veterans who you help also, you have to ask yourself, why on earth do they put their lives on the line, and why on earth did so many of them pay such a horrific price to fight for what?
Oh, they do. And so many of them, Mike, would be coming back home with one limb, both legs gone, one arm gone, and one arm left. I mean, it would just break your heart to see the dedication of these young men who you know are going to be in the system, and I mean in the healthcare system.
Yeah, absolutely.
In services for the next 60 years because they're all young. They're 22. They're married. They have kids. You know, this is the way it is.
And they put their lives on the line to defend a country that our leaders are giving away.
Oh, they do. It's just really unbelievable, the patriotism of our men and women in the military. And I'll tell you, my heart goes out to them every day. Every day.
You betcha.
Every
Mine
day.
As well.
Well, it's been my pleasure. And I'll
Thank
email you.
You,
and I look forward to coming on again.
Absolutely. Have a wonderful weekend, Sherilyn. And thank you again. It was great meeting you on the air today.
My pleasure. Have a great weekend as well.
Thank you. Folks, that was Sherilyn. And again, this is what I try to do on this program, is to bring you some guests who bring with them a wealth of knowledge and experience and perspectives, and whether you always agree with the folks who join me on the air, whether you even agree with me, that's fine. We're Americans. We're not only entitled to disagree, it's our right and our obligation on occasion to disagree. But that's what the First Amendment is all about. I'm a great practitioner and a great believer in the First Amendment. So again, I'm I'm here trying to get the message out there that if we the people got involved with our own government, became the best employers of our employees, because that's what elected representatives are. That is what mayors and governors and senators and members of Congress are. That is what the President of the United States is. He is an employee of we the people, because this is supposed to be a government by the people. We have failed abysmally to make our elected representatives accountable. And if you're sitting there thinking, I'm just one person, I want you to remember that the biggest flood starts with that first raindrop. If you go to a restaurant, I doubt strongly that you have ever told a waiter or waitress, just throw some crap on the plate and I will eat it. We are generally very specific about the food that we want to eat and the way that we expect it to be prepared. We need to be no less demanding of those people who control the destiny of our country and the future of our kids and grandchildren. That's our responsibility. There's an expression that, you know, the mice will play when the cat's away. Well, we are the cat. We bear the responsibility to make our government accountable. That's what it's about. That's why I write the articles and why I take the time to do the radio program and my television program and write other articles for AND magazine at TalkBorder, one word, TalkBorder.com. That's why I have been writing for years for Californians for Population Stabilization. And again, their website is capsweb.org, C-A-P-S, capsweb.org. If you need to reach me directly, Michael Cutler, one word, M-I-C-H-A-E-L, C-U-T-L-E-R, michaelcutler.net. But, you know, probably the easiest way of getting me, in fact, is through talkborder.com or capsweb.org, because my goal, and it has been my goal, especially since the attacks of 9/11, when the ashes from that conflagration at Ground Zero landed on my home, my goal has been to provide my perspectives from where I've been. As an immigration agent, I had a front row seat to so much of what now is coming back to bite us on the rear end. The idea that we have not secured our nation's borders. The fact that there are millions of people inside our country and there is no reliable way of knowing who they are or why they're here. This isn't an expression of xenophobia, by the way. This isn't about saying anybody who speaks with an accent is dangerous. What I am saying is that there is a legal process in place, and it's been in place for God knows how long, of a lawful immigration system going back many decades, going back over a century, where we would know who is coming in. We'd make certain that the people coming in did not pose a threat to our safety or well-being. Ellis Island, which the open border anarchists jump up and down and speak so wistfully about, oh, my God, they've closed Ellis Island. Please remember, Ellis Island was a quarantine station. You had Alcatraz on the west coast, which was on an island. It was a prison for the worst of the worst. There was no way of getting from Alcatraz to San Francisco without a boat. So the idea was if you were on Alcatraz Island, you stayed there unless the authorities wanted to let you off. Ellis Island was no different. That's where foreign nationals, aliens, if you will, seeking to enter the United States would first arrive. They'd be checked out by public health. They would do what they could to try to figure out who these folks were, make certain that they weren't a threat to our well-being, and only then were they put on a boat and brought to the mainland. You didn't just come to America and say, here I am. Ellis Island was not simply a formality, and in fact, more than half the aliens who came to Ellis Island, whether they were with or without families, were turned around. If families got divided up, they had a choice. You can stay and your relatives can go home, or we'll let you all go home together. But, you know, the people that were deemed unacceptable were not given any second opportunities. They were sent packing. So this was done in an orderly fashion. It wasn't about racism or xenophobia. It's about protecting America, protecting our country, protecting our citizens. Again, I remind you, the immigration laws do not differentiate. Don't make a point of saying, well, this color, this race or that race. No, those laws are colorblind. It's just about making certain that aliens entering the United States don't pose a threat. Go back again, Title 8, United States Code, Section 212. It's in the law. The open borders anarchists may take issue, but I advise them and I advise you, look at the law. Look who we are under that law supposed to keep out. And by the way, that same law that they scream about provides access to our country for more than 1.1 million lawful immigrants every year. And it's also under that law that we admit well over 100 million non-immigrant visitors, aliens who are here for a temporary period of time. Of course, we don't enforce the laws, so when they overstay, when these foreign workers take jobs they're not supposed to take or fail to show up for a job for which they were admitted, fail to attend schools for which they were admitted, we do nothing about it. And, you know, unlike the laws of physics, man's laws are only relevant if they're enforced. If you fail to enforce the laws, guess what happens? The law may as well not exist. Under this administration, our immigration laws essentially no longer exist. And now the newest war cry, the numbers are down, they're not coming anymore, so we don't have to build a fence, we don't have to enforce the laws, the problem is solving itself. And if you believe that story, then I will introduce you to the Tooth Fairy at some point. I mean, this is an absurdity, but this is where we are today. We have politicians from both sides of the aisle who absolutely see the immigration laws as an impediment to their goals. They want the cheap labor. They want the campaign contributions. They want the votes. They want the support. You have lots of people making lots of money. If you go to the social contract, I wrote an article this past month. It's a quarterly publication. My article was entitled Immigration, the Modern Day Gold Rush. There's lots of people feeding at the trough. The people being hurt by all this, you and I, folks. People competing for the jobs now. People who are finding that we are allowing more criminals into the United States. And again, I want to be clear. It doesn't mean even if you're an illegal alien that you're a felon or a drug dealer or whatever. But again, I would remind you that part of who we are supposed to keep out are the criminals. It's estimated that 27% of the inmate population in the federal jails are now illegal aliens. I can assure you that even the most pessimistic estimates of how many illegals are in the country does not come close to 27%, at least not so far. So we know that there's a disproportionate relationship of illegal aliens with crime in the United States, which makes sense. You have people coming here who are fleeing law enforcement in other countries, or they're coming here to commit crimes specifically in our country, whether they're members of gangs or drug cartels or what have you, organized crime. So this is why those immigration laws are just so vital. This is why we as Americans need to make certain that our voices are heard by our elected representatives. And you will know you're successful when you can call up your member of Congress or your senator and the staff knows your voice. That's your obligation. That's the obligation that we the people all have to make our government accountable. You know, I always like to say at the end of my commentaries, democracy is not a spectator sport. I thank you for joining me this past hour. Hope you enjoyed my guest. Certainly Sherilyn is thought-provoking and a very bright young lady. It was a privilege to have her on the program. We will do what we can to get more exciting guests each week, both on this program and at if I can get the words out, folks, talkborder.com. Please go to those websites. Go to capsweb.org. I wish you all a great weekend, and again, see you next time, same place. Good night, everybody. Have a terrific weekend.